current state on 90.5 WKAR. Welcome back. I'm Mark Bayshore. What is happening here on Friday? Detroit Emergency Manager Kevin Orr, according to the Detroit Free Press, contemplating a plan that would replace existing health care benefits for some Detroit City retirees with $125 cash a month. That $125 apparently would be to buy coverage on the state's new health insurance exchange. We will see how that goes. Morris Peterson, who many of you remember, a former Spartan Hoops standout, will be inducted into the MSU Sports Hall of Fame. Pretty worthy inductee, I think. And speaking of sports, WKAR's current sports will debut Al Martin's new TV show tonight. This is WKAR-TV's current sports with Al Martin tonight, 10 p.m. If you've caught Al's daily sports talk show here on AM 870 and you like it, you're gonna like this. Greg Kelser is his first special guest tonight. At the top of the show today, Republicans in Michigan and around the country are locked in a debate over the party's direction and priorities. The division between centrists like Governor Rick Snyder and the GOP's Tea Party wing have grown more noticeable recently. In July, Wes Nakagiri of the Tea Party group Retake Our Gov told WKAR-TV's Tim Skubick that he supports a challenge to Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly at next year's GOP convention. Nakagiri and others complain that Governor Snyder's number two should present more conservative views that challenge Snyder's. Now, this and other differences have encouraged state Democrats over their election prospects in 2014. Last week, the Dems leaked a memo describing the Michigan GOP as, quote, coming apart at the seams. We thought we'd get the assessment of a longtime Lansing-based Republican consultant. Stephen Linder is the president of the Sterling Corporation, and Sterling currently works on strategy for Michigan's Senate Republican Caucus. Welcome to Current State, Steve.
Good morning, Mark. Thanks for having me.
Glad you came in. So is coming apart at the seams accurate, or are you going to mount a challenge to that assessment?
Well, you need to separate headlines from reality. So we have a Republican governor, a Republican secretary of state, a Republican attorney general, a super majority in the Senate, largest number of Republicans in the Senate in history, 26 to 12. You've got a sustained majority in the House. We have a majority Republican delegation in Congress. If that's coming apart at the seams, the Dems better hope we don't ever get our act together.
Well, seriously, though, I mean, you've got people like Wes Nakagiri who really would like to see somebody more conservative in the number two position. And the Tea Party doesn't appear to be going away anytime soon. How do you assess their influence in the larger party?
Well, first, let's talk about the Tea Party a little bit. We've really allowed Democrats to define what the Tea Party is. And, of course, the Tea Party is not a party. It's a movement. T is an acronym, taxed enough already. If that's the case, then I'm Tea Party. I've been a small government, less regulation, low tax conservative for over 40 years. So anybody who thinks that they're not paying enough in taxes obviously wouldn't support the Tea Party. If the Tea Party had not materialize as a group of people who said enough. We've got enough of debt at the national level. Government is too big. It's interfering in our lives. It's insidious. The map of the United States would look very, very different. It was because of this movement of people that woke up, got themselves involved in democracy, went out, worked the precincts, went to the polls. Republicans would not have I believe we've got 26 or 27 completely red states in the United States right now. We've got 31 Republican governors, and we have a majority at least in the House of Representatives. The Tea Party has been very good for the Republican Party. However, because it's a movement, there's a leadership vacuum, and it has been filled by people who really have not served the hardworking folks that got out and helped Republicans score victories over the last two election cycles. It has not served them very well. I know Brian Kelly. Lieutenant Governor Kelly is a good friend. He is one of the most conservative people I know. It is just preposterous that anybody would say that Lieutenant Governor Kelly is not conservative. And I also challenge the notion that a lieutenant governor should be a counterweight or a challenge to the governor. The lieutenant governor serves the governor. Governor Snyder picked him, and he picked him to serve him. And the lieutenant governor ought to be the pick and the choice of the governor.
For our listeners who missed it, I'd like to revisit your recent interaction with former Michigan GOP State Rep. Jack Hogendyke. Jack is the conservative ex-member of the House, a Ron Paul supporter. The differences between you two seem to capture the differences between the so-called mainstream Republicans on one side and those in or sympathetic to the Tea Party on the other. Isn't that accurate?
There's not really any philosophical difference between Jack and I, if you look at where we come down on issues. My issue with Jack, who, by the way, is a nice guy, he's a fine man, he's, you know, got very good values and principles, is that instead of helping us by becoming a positive force, Jack got caught up in all of the ne'er-do-wells within the Tea Party movement and started talking about litmus tests for Republicans. And really, the litmus test was not even a test. It was a moving line. Every vote became the vote if you were in the legislature that was going to determine whether the Tea Party was going to support or oppose you. I'm sorry. When you're in the legislature, your role is to govern.
But and Mr. Hogendyke wanted to go rhino hunting. I think that is really what the line that an awful lot of people remember. R-I-N-O, open. He wanted to declare open season on Republicans in name only.
Right. And who is he or Trucker Randy or Doug Sedenquist or Wes Nakagiri to decide who is a true Republican or Republican in name only? And look, the record for these guys has not been good. I pointed out to Jack in my letter to him that he's tried rhino hunting before. He's lost every time since he left the House when he's run for office on his quote-unquote rhino hunting mission against Congressman Upton. Trucker Randy Bishop lost in a primary.
Tell us more about Trucker Randy and the other fellow.
Doug Sedenquist.
Doug Sedenquist.
There are two individuals who have been very successful at somehow or other making themselves appear to be leaders whose voices matter. One of them, and both of them, are from the northwest part of the state, Randy Bishop and Doug Sedenquist. They had a radio show. I don't think it's on the air anymore. I think it's an internet show right now. But they've been very loud, very boisterous, attacking, ad hominem, no basis for many of the attacks that they've fostered. Trucker Randy started a campaign against the Senate Majority Leader, and that was beat back and with a threat of a lawsuit. And you look at these guys. I mean, Trucker Randy has a rap sheet. He's got multiple instances of non-payment of child support. He's been convicted of defrauding investors in real estate deals. His radio co-host, Doug Sedenquist, was just arrested in Wisconsin after a standoff with police where he threatened to shoot himself. I mean, you know, these guys are like the dark side of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. I mean, why should anybody listen to anything that these guys have to say at all?
And yet they're under the same umbrella that you are.
Well, look, democracy is open. Anybody that wants to run for precinct delegate, attend a party convention, I take my hat off to them. Because democracy does not work very well when people don't participate. What I don't like is when people use the positions that they work themselves into not to inspire, not to motivate, not to talk about the good things that the Republican Party stands for, but to basically appoint themselves as arbiters of what is a conservative and attack each other. The point I made to Jack Hogendyke, if you'll recall reading my email letter to him, is the goal is to beat Democrats, to control gavels, to help push our agenda by electing majorities, not to beat each other up.
Let's revisit this discussion of a challenge to Lieutenant Governor Calley at the convention next year. We mentioned Wes Nakagiri earlier of the Tea Party group Retake Our Gov over in Heartland, Michigan. Here is Wes Nakagiri back in July on WKAR-TV's Off the Record.
His inner circle, you know, folks like Bill Rustem, a gentleman named Baird, and much more. I'm told by longtime insiders that those people are, you can't really categorize them as conservatives. I mean, Rustem was part of the Milliken administration, and I wouldn't consider Milliken a conservative. So the governor gets all his advice from the less conservative part of the spectrum. We think it would be better policy making if he had advice from somebody who had conservative values.
And we just want to clarify his inner circle. He's referring to Governor Snyder when he says that. You disagree with that, then? You maintain that there's nothing wrong with Lieutenant Governor Calley and the governor being very much in sync on policy?
No, and there's nothing. Not only nothing wrong, I think it's required. The governor sets policy. People around him are charged with helping him to enact policy. You listen to what Wes said. I'm told that Dennis Muchmore and Bill Rustem, who, by the way, are personal friends of mine, Rich Baird, I have only met and respect his professional accomplishments greatly, are wonderful people. They're strategic. They're tactical. They understand the system. And why would you base an opinion that then manifests itself in an attack on the governor and the lieutenant governor based on second and third hand conjecture and innuendo? Has he ever sat down with Dennis Muchmore or Bill Rustem or Rich Baird and actually talked to them about their views? I doubt they'd speak with him. But why would you conduct and organize a campaign to basically replace the governor's pick for lieutenant governor based on secondhand information and innuendo and conjecture and ad hominem attacks by people that are of very questionable reputation?
We're talking with Steve Linder of Lansing's Sterling Corporation. Sterling advises the Senate Majority Republican Caucus at the Capitol. The governor got some good news yesterday from a Free Press WXYZ-TV poll that indicates an 8 percentage point lead over likely candidate Mark Schauer. What did you think when you saw that spread?
Well, it's not surprising. This governor and his allies in the legislature, the Senate Majority Leader, Speaker of the House, and their caucuses have enacted a breathtaking legislative agenda. I mean, even Governor Engler commented that he's never seen a more comprehensive, aggressive set of major policy initiatives ever in the state of Michigan. And he was credited with having a breathtaking agenda himself. I mean, if you look at all of the things that we've done, it's really quite staggering. And it's not surprising that he's doing well against Mark Schauer. I mean, look, the Dems have put two very weak candidates as their standard bearers at the top of the ticket in Mark Schauer and Gary Peters. Mark Schauer lost to the people in a district where the people know him the best, his congressional district, to Tim Walberg. That was his last campaign, was a losing campaign in his hometown. Gary Peters lost his attorney general race to Mike Cox. He did get elected to Congress. So the record of both of these individuals running for office is not good.
And that accounts for the 8 percentage point difference, you think, in the poll? Is that primarily is what in play?
No, I think the governor is doing well because people understand that the governor is starting to lead Michigan back by instilling sound management principles into state government that are now accounting for an increase in commerce and jobs.
This 8 percentage point lead comes 9 months after an absolute eruption of protest in Lansing over the passage of right right to work.
You mean freedom to choose.
Freedom to choose.
Yeah, that's right.
Freedom to work, freedom to whatever we want
that's
to call
right.
it.
That's
it gets
right.
called an awful
that's,
lot of different things.
That's right.
Very interestingly enough. What's going on there, though? 9 months after an eruption on the state capitol grounds that we haven't seen the likes of for many years. And an 8 percentage point lead. It surprised me. I will admit.
Well, the number of people that work in organized labor these days is at an all-time low. I think labor and the Dems rolled the dice on this one issue, thinking it was going to be divisive, and they lost. People of Michigan understand that there is a private relationship between employees and employers. And I think the people of Michigan finally understand that while organized labor at one time was a benefit, it is now a liability to expanding commerce in Michigan.
We've got less than a minute, Stephen. I would like to get your take on the Free Press XYZ poll from Epic MRA, actually conducted the poll, on the apparent dead heat between Republican Terry Lynn Land and Democrat Gary Peters.
Again, Gary Peters is in office right now. Terry Lynn Land was not in office, but she is a statewide office holder. And I think the fact that the Dems have touted Gary Peters as the savior of Carl Levin's seat, and right now he's struggling against somebody who hasn't been in office for a couple of years and just starting up a campaign, is a very, very bad sign for Gary Peters.
Yes or no, would you have preferred Mike Rogers or Dave Camp to be running for U.S. Senate?
I prefer who is ever going to win the nomination.
We will interpret that however we...
That's right.
Very good. Steve Linder is the co-founder of the Sterling Corporation. He works on strategy for Michigan's Senate Republican Caucus. Good conversation, Steve. Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Current State on WKAR. The Lansing Symphony Orchestra's first Masterworks concert is tomorrow night at Wharton Center. It features music of Dvorak and Enescu and a modern percussion concerto. And lest you are tempted to make a joke about starting the season out with a bang, conductor Timothy Muffet has this admonition.
Percussionists prefer the word strike to bang. First of all, we'll put that one out there.
Muffet came to our studios to talk with our Melissa Benmark about the music on the program, and they began the conversation with a look at that concerto, that percussion concerto by Jennifer Higdon.
So Jennifer Higdon is really one of America's most important living composers and one of the most frequently played. I mean, her music shows up on all across the country on orchestra seasons and other seasons. This is a work that actually received the Grammy for Best Classical Composition. In the year that it was written. And it was written for a percussionist named Colin Curry, and it's had quite a life of its own with him playing it across the country. It's a 25-minute piece. It's interesting because the solo percussionist is very much integrated into the orchestral fabric. So it's not all – in fact, many times her line is doubled in other instruments in the orchestra, in the piano, in the celesta, or even in the percussion section. The orchestral percussion section is very involved in this work as well. That's not to say she doesn't have her moments in the sun, because she certainly does. But it's very interesting the way the composer came at this piece and thinking of the concept of a percussion concerto. Much of it is pitched percussion, so marimba, vibraphone, and then in the percussion section, glockenspiel and chimes. But there's also quite a bit written for non-pitched percussion, the tom-toms and woodblocks and cymbals and the many, many things that belong in a percussion kit. So she plays an enormous number of instruments. I can't even begin to count them. It's a very colorful piece, very American sounding to me, to my ears. Jennifer Higdon, we did a work of hers called Blue Cathedral a couple of years ago to kind of introduce her to the audience. And then this is an extension of that.
Starting out the program, the Romanian Rhapsody that I kind of considered to be the father of all Romanian Rhapsodies, even though I don't know if it was written, you know, if it was the first one or not, but the UNESCO Romanian Rhapsody number one. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, this just seemed like a really fun way to kick off the season. It's a piece that's firmly rooted in Romanian folk tradition, real fireworks for the orchestra. It's starting with lots of lovely solo passages for the woodwinds, kind of set up the folksy melody, and then once everybody kicks in, it's a race to the end, really. It's just a very exciting and fun, powerful piece. I wanted to kick off the season with something that would really get people, get their blood pumping.
Yeah, pretty much if you're not dancing or trying to by the end of this, it's not working.
Right, yeah.
It will work, believe me. The major piece on the work is the Symphony No. 7 by Dvorak. Of course, Dvorak known for coming to America and doing the New World Symphony. This one apparently written for the Philharmonic Society of London, and there are some notes about him really feeling like he wants to export Czech music to the world and see what that does. So what about this symphony sticks out as being the tastiest parts, do you think, that he was offering?
Sure. I think this is Dvorak's greatest symphony, easily. It's the work where, and it's not to take anything away from his other great symphonies. He was a terrific symphonist. But I feel like the stars really aligned for him in this one, that we have still all the things that we love about Dvorak, the extraordinarily beautiful melodies, that rustic, folksy sense. And this, I kind of saw this work as this work and the UNESCO as bookends, as kind of folk-related bookends on the program. So there's kind of an arc between the two of them. We have all the things that we love about Dvorak, and as I was saying, in those melodies and in the general character of the music. But what really comes together is his compositional skill in this piece, I think more so than in any of the other symphonies. The idea of melodies, the way he develops the melodies and the motives of the piece are so remarkably coherent in this piece, and they hold together so beautifully. That in some of Dvorak's works, there's more of a tendency of a stringing together of melodic ideas. And fortunately, they're extraordinary melodies, so we don't mind that as the listener. And he'll develop them just by modulation into other keys. But here there's a real sense of development in the sort of Haydn-Beethoven tradition, where little fragments that we've heard out presented as a melody become the connecting material between and also become the expansive material. So, without getting too technical, which I already have, Dvorak really kind of finds a compositional voice in this symphony that is unique, I think, in his symphonic output. And it really is very, very successful. We hear a lot of his Brahmsian influence in this. We hear some Wagnerian influence, which we don't often think of the two, but Dvorak was very much influenced by Wagner, and I think that's very much apparent in this piece. There are some kind of forest murmury sections there, the way he uses harmony, hearken to Wagner a little bit. But having said all that, it's pure Dvorak when you look at the whole. And this is a piece that I believe is remarkably inspired from beginning to the end and just makes for an incredibly satisfying live concert experience.
That's so interesting to me to think of him being inspired by Brahms, because Brahms was so inspired by Beethoven and was so worried about his symphony writing.
Right.
And then to think, I believe it was the Brahms Third that Dvorak was kind of going, hey, you know, I want to do something kind of like that.
Right. And he found his own voice that, you know, Brahms too was very much influenced by the music of the people. And there's gypsy music in all of Brahms, but it's very highly polished and refined. And what sets Dvorak, you know, his uniqueness is that he keeps a little bit of the grit and the dirt under the fingernails in his music, and that you feel that folk connection a little bit more powerfully. And I think that's why he really was a composer that many, many people resonated with.
Timothy Muffet, thank you for joining us.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
For Current State, I'm Melissa Benmark.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Imagine if we could solve all the world's problems in a week. Global warming, famine, diseases, ethnic tension, all resolved. Sounds impossible, right? Well, apparently it's not. At least it's not for John Hunter's students. Over 30 years ago, the Virginia-based teacher created the World Peace Game. To play, students take on the role of world leaders and are charged with solving 50 interlocking problems. Students win if they fix all 50 crises and if every country's asset value increases. Hunter has written a book and given a TED Talk about the World Peace Game. He and his students were also featured in the 2010 documentary World Peace and Other Fourth Grade Achievements. A pleasure to welcome John Hunter to Current State.
Oh, thank you, Mark. Pleasure to be here.
What do you make of East Lansing?
I'm having a blast. I've been talking to young people who are my only hope, and they've been so inspiring, really. So I feel very optimistic being here.
We introduced just the bare bones of the World Peace Game. Give us a little bit more insight into how this works. What roles the students take on and what problems they're trying to solve.
Sure. It's a 4-foot by 4-foot by 4-foot plexiglass tower, the structure of the game itself. There are four levels that emulate the earth, an undersea level, a ground and sea level, aircraft and outer space level. It towers above my 9-year-olds who usually play the game. There are four country teams of cabinets, a UN, a World Bank, and an arms dealers group. We even have a random weather goddess who runs a stock market and random events that occur. And a saboteur, one kid who's often in the office for causing trouble. I use that skill set to have that child play secretly to undermine the entire process while trying to achieve the public aims of the game, too.
So you have tried to recreate the advantages of the real world and the disadvantages of the real world.
We're putting kids into the realm of life itself rather than waiting until they're graduates and then go out into the real world in a safe way, though, appropriate way.
What did you hope students would learn through playing when you created the World Peace Game? What was the end game?
Well, you know, originally when I first started this in 1978 as a young teacher, I wanted to do what I thought was the goal of teaching, basically to impart information and stir knowledge and that kind of thing. But the students have shown me through this practice over decades now, I think the real purpose of education is to develop a wonderful, fantastic, compassionate human being. And that's not written in our text, and it's not in our curriculum guides, but that seems to be the arc of the long-term assessment, what kind of person you become. And that, I think, is what they're saying is the real goal of what we're trying to do in education.
Okay. And so does that require not looking at a child as a child?
Well, you see them as an individual, unique and not completely formed as we all are, with their own experiences, their own inner wisdom and knowledge. And so I acknowledge the children as unique individuals when we meet, realizing they have a unique set of experiences and wisdom that I do not have. And I invite them to share leadership in the classroom with me. We have a classroom of co-teachers, 30 co-teachers in my room with me. So that makes our learning power much greater, I think.
I am so struck by the fact that somebody is appointed an international arms dealer.
You know, often my girls want that job. I don't know what it is. You know,
what
my arms dealers wear lace, you know.
What does that say?
Well, they're very wise about it because often they start out selling arms and realize, wait a minute, if I'm very successful, I'll have no customers. And they often dissolve their businesses and turn them into charities or invest in agriculture and solar energy. Who knew, you know, arms dealers liquidating their inventory.
Oh, my word. The game, I take it, often results in a spontaneous lesson that you say you could not have taught.
That's right.
Your students.
That's right.
So I'd like to discuss some of those lessons, starting with a 9-year-old girl who was a defense minister
That's
of
right.
one of the poorest nations in the game.
You
she
got it.
She's kind of along the lines of our previous exchange here. The defense minister of one of the poorest nations in the game decided to attack a rich neighboring country unprovoked.
Unprovoked. It broke my heart. You know, you can tell I'm kind of a peacenik, I guess. I lean that way. But the game allows the students to be fully human and to engage in whatever activity they want to, warfare or not, as long as they can afford the activity and deal with the consequences. They can pay for it and deal with the consequences. And so she, for some unknown reason, attacked a large, wealthy, oil-rich neighbor right next door, marched her tank battalion in, surrounded their oil fields, locked down their fuel supply, and everybody's mad at her. Her prime minister said, "What are you doing? You know, this is insane. This is a peace game."
This
Why?
Is Iraq and Kuwait about 15 years ago is what it is.
Kind of sounds like that.
Yes.
Doesn't it? I didn't intend that, but that's what the students made of it. Come to find out a few game days later, a few rounds of play later, that she had seen the trend lines and what was coming. She knew that an attack was imminent from that larger country to seek world domination, and she couldn't get anybody to believe her, so she took it upon herself philosophically, made a philosophical decision to go in and start a small war to avert a larger war. Mm. I mean, how deep critically in thinking that is, it's astounding. I couldn't have designed a lesson like that, but she took us to a place that was much deeper for us all, really.
How about that? Another student you talk about in your book, World Peace and Other Fourth Grade Achievements, is Pablo. Tell us how the game influenced Pablo.
Pablo influenced us, I think. Pablo was what we all would call a loser. He just was very slow, and he seemed not very with it. And people tended to work around him and just discount him. But I sensed something in him. There was a leadership quality I felt. You know, you couldn't prove it, you couldn't test for it, but I felt something was there. I offered him the leadership role of prime minister. And in my naive way, hoping that would sort of immediately turn him around. And, of course, he broke my heart and proceeded to be just very slow and seemingly uninvolved for 5 weeks. And at the sixth week, something happened to Pablo. I could see it coming. His hands were trembling a bit. His eyes got really wide. And suddenly he moved to the board, made his moves. And I think he made something like 22 moves in about 3 minutes. He looked like a Jedi master in slow motion, moving pieces on all the levels of the board. And I was astounded. I said, "Pablo, you see it all." He said, "Mr. Hunter, I see everything." He had this sort of epiphany, this kind of grok, this kind of massive meta moment where he understood the entire equation of the game. And we were all astounded and applauded, really. We were just overjoyed. Pablo got it, but we hadn't thought he would, but he was allowed the chance to find his own way over time. Failure is a stock and trade for us. We think failure is a wonderful luxury because it's part of life. It's the way things are. So we don't protect children from that. We give them experience in handling and dealing with it and coming through it.
So all the while Pablo was watching this unfold, he was taking in an awful lot more than what it looked.
That's
than,
right. Appearances are so deceiving.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
right.
When your students play the World Peace game, you also have them read The Art of War by Sun Tzu. And we've got a clip from the documentary film about John Hunter, about this game, in which one of your students reflects upon
That's
the
right.
art of war.
That's
this
right.
is in the context of the game he is playing.
"We've really had enough of people attacking. I mean, we've been lucky. I mean, the time, now I'm feeling really weird because I'm living what Sun Tzu said 1 week. 1 week he said, those who go into battle and win and will want to go back, and those who lose in battle will want to go back and win. And so I've been winning battles, so I'm sort of going into battles, more battles. And I think it's sort of weird to be living what Sun Tzu said."
That is a fourth grader
saying
that.
It's incredible.
That could be a college student
or
a high schooler at least.
Well, he had lived through it. And you know, the beautiful thing was, the funny thing, I went to look for that quote later and Sun Tzu never said that. David had recontextualized his understanding of a quote from Sun Tzu in his own way to fit his situation and learned a much deeper lesson than Sun Tzu ever intended. Mm. David was caught in a cycle of war and violence, and he saw that rather than this is right, that is wrong. He saw the larger picture through his own experience and interpreting Sun Tzu in his own way.
Have you've had some kind of contact over over this World Peace game with federal officials, correct?
You might say that, yeah.
How so?
Well, we were invited to screen the film at the United Nations, which was a huge and just deeply impactful meeting, because those officials who lived that experience we were playing at really understood through the film, and there were tears in the room. But then one day we got an invitation from this very well-dressed woman, "Miss Hunter, we'd like to see you," and it was from the Defense Department, Pentagon, is what her card said. And so we made our way, that Chris Farina, the wonderful filmmaker of the film, and myself, made our way through the security into the Pentagon to find out what we were wanted for. And we found out the film had been screened 4 times at the Pentagon to policy and military people before we even arrived. They screened it a 5th time and had a 2-hour, deeply moving conversation with us, you know, a broke filmmaker and a small town school teacher, about creating empty space, which is what the World Peace Game allows. And they said, you know, we're human, we're hurting, we're suffering, we have colleagues and friends we've lost. You know, we know how to make war, we do that very well. We don't know how to create that empty space.
What does that mean? So create empty space.
So the game itself is sort of an open template where there's no real solution. You've got to come to it. And it's just chaos that appears when you start. But yet, out of that non-directive environment, students evolve or develop or create something. So there's an emptiness, an openness to their beginning and playing. And I think the officials there caught on to that space, that reflective open space where you take time to completely digest and probe the chaos itself without reacting immediately, without coming up with a plan, without having an agenda. And they asked us about it, and then 2 weeks later they invited my students to come to the Pentagon. 23 of my students went and had a mock press conference where they stumped the Pentagon press brief secretary a couple of times, actually, asking him some very tough questions. And we got a tour. We had a beautiful time, and then suddenly a door opens. We're ushered into the office of then-Defense Secretary Leon Panetta. Now, he and the 2, 3, and 4-star generals from all branches of the service who spent the entire morning with my students were not there for a photo op, a warm, fuzzy meeting. They were there for a policy, peer-to-peer discussion. Generals talking to 9-year-olds saying, "We handle insurgents in the field like this. How do you handle them?" And my students could answer. "Our supply chains are disrupted by global warming like this in the field. What do you do about it?" And the students could answer. Such respect, such amazing understanding and openness to solutions. You know, it wasn't the heartless, faceless war machine we thought it was. There were people there with hearts like us.
That's just extraordinary. Yeah. John Hunter is our guest, the creator of the World Peace Game here on Current State on WKAR. The game's over 30 years old at this point, and the world has changed an awful lot in three decades. Has the game been altered to reflect those changes?
Oh, yeah. The students insist upon it. "Mr. Hunter, we've got to have drones in the game. We need cyber hacking and cyber warfare. They're now in the game. We need a nation like North Korea that won't talk to anybody very much. We have that in the game now." And, of course, those vectors, those interdependent, interlocking problem scenarios I have to design in an appropriate way for children, a bloodless, safe way, and yet cause them to think so deeply. And there's no way out. There's no way to win this game. I can't win this game, and I invented it. But yet, 35 years of playing, they continue to save the world every time.
So you don't let students win in the game. One huge challenge here, too, is, I mean, on top of all of the issues that you have referred to, it is important that each country's asset value must increase.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe that was behind the attack on the oil fields. That was a
quick way
to increase the asset value.
But, you know, the thing is that they're interlocking. They come to realize the interdependency of life. So if they were to deplete one area to increase their own, we're still not winning, because that ultimate goal of everyone's welfare being better off is not attained. So that gradual understanding of the multiple interlocking consequences dawns on them as they move beyond the impulsive behavior that first actions always seem to lead us to. And they do win. They win every time by achieving those goals, but in unorthodox ways I never could have planned or predicted. So it's really beyond my control. I've ceded control of the game to the students.
Do you feel like the World Peace Game flies in the face of the trend toward standardizing things? It would appear that it does.
Well, you know, I've understood in teaching. My master teachers from decades ago taught me that one size does not fit all. And they said initially, in total, that you have to look at each individual student and see what it is they love, what they care about, and who they really are, and then build curriculum to them, to that. And that really individualizes things, so you really can't have a sort of a mass program suited to all as sort of a common denominator. And that kind of teaching, I think, is richer and deeper where you do approach each student individually. It takes more time, more effort, more insight, and more work, but we're there to serve. We're servants, and so it's not for our comfort or convenience that we do this. We do this for each child's sake individually.
John Hunter is a Virginia-based teacher and creator of the World Peace Game. I recommend his TED Talk online, by the way, too. It's excellent. His book is called World Peace and Other Fourth Grade Achievements. John is in East Lansing for the Residential College of Arts and Humanities Wednesday Night Live series. A pleasure, John. Good luck.
Mark, thank you so much.
This summer, MSU assistant professor Etienne Charles debuted his fourth album called Creole Soul. It's received favorable reviews from the New York Times and NPR and spent some time high up on the jazz charts. The album is a mix of folk, jazz, calypso, reggae, Haitian voodoo music, and more. Charles, who is also one of the MSU professors of jazz, will be playing some of his music at the Broad Museum tonight. WKAR's Melissa Benmark spoke with Etienne Charles about his album, his thoughts on music, and what caused him to pick up the trumpet as his primary instrument.
I didn't pick it, so my uncle gave me a trumpet. He was like, here. And I was like, okay, thank you.
How old were you then?
I was 10.
And that's not an easy instrument to just pick up. Not, you know, any kid can bang on a piano, but...
It requires instruction. And, so after my exams had finished, my parents set me up with some lessons, and they continued, and then I started playing in bands. When I was about 11, 12, I started playing in a few different bands around town. And, stopped for a couple of years because I had braces, so...
Oh.
Started playing percussion and drums then, and then picked it back up when I was 16.
That's amazing that you had that break in there, and you know, because so many people who play from such a young age just are constantly at it, and that says a lot about you as a musician that you were able to withstand having a couple years off because of the braces like that.
Yeah, it was like being in jail. It was torture, you know. It was really torture. I mean, I could not wait for the day that my teeth were straight, I guess, as they call it, so that I could get back on the horn.
Reading the articles and interviews with you and that have been written about you, there's a lot of focus on the fusion of various cultures' music, and that's clearly a rich source for your music. But do you ever sometimes get a little bit tired of people taking apart, saying, you know, oh, this came from this and this came from this? And it, I mean, doesn't sometimes the creative process isn't part of that not really necessarily knowing, you know, having it cut up into little pieces that this came from this and this came from this, is that you kind of bring it all together as a whole?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's funny because I just write music the way I hear it. I don't think about what different elements I'm going to put in, you know, because that's the difference between a recipe and a tune. Because a recipe going in, you have quite a good idea of what's going to go into the food. Whereas with a tune, you have no idea when you sit down at that piano. So for me, I don't think about that going in. And yeah, I like for people to just enjoy the sound, you know, just think about it as... you know, as a sound piece, a sound color.
Just looking at the 1900s and the early 2000s where jazz is concerned, in my father's day, jazz was king. That was it. It just was. When I first started in public radio in the 80s, if you want to play jazz, you had to go to Europe. Where do you think jazz is in America right now?
It's in a few places. It's definitely in academia. So a lot of the performance opportunities are actually in schools, like academia, you know. So a lot of performers are taking up positions as professors at different universities around the country. And also in Europe, it's starting to take a big turn towards academia. Jazz clubs are becoming less and less, and specifically rooms where people can go just to listen to jazz. And it's becoming more expensive. You know, it's becoming, you know, performing arts centers, you know, their tickets tend to be, you know, on a minimum of about $30, $35, $40. So, you know, the music is becoming less accessible. But then again, there's, you know, you can listen to anything on the internet, so you can develop a love for the music that's hopefully going to make you want to come out. I personally try to keep my tickets on the low side because we want people to come and experience the music, because for us, it's about the connection between the band and the audience. But yeah, it's an interesting time because, you know, a lot of people are saying that jazz is on the decline and that, you know, the performance opportunities are no longer what they used to be. But musicians have been saying that for 80 years. That it's not the same as it used to be. And so I highly always encourage people to go find their audiences, go play, you know, build it up from scratch.
Where do you find that today's college students are getting inspiration?
A lot of it, they get the inspiration from normally a mentor that they had as a youngster. Maybe their band teacher may have given them a jazz CD to listen to, or maybe they met a jazz musician in the town and, you know, started learning from them. And then the thing about the internet now, the World Wide Web, you know, you can go on YouTube and you can watch John Coltrane play, you know, any time of day, any time of night. So it's actually more to inspire you now than, say, 10, 15 years ago. But I still say there needs to be more chances for them to go and hear the music, and specifically hear the legends of this music, you know, so that they could hear people like Jimmy Heath and Kenny Barron, Roy Haynes, because, you know, and that's where the academia comes in, because we get to bring these people in as guest artists, so they still get a chance to interact with them.
You wrote, it looks like, most of the material on Creole Soul. I know it's hard to ask you to pick a favorite. It's like saying which of your kids is your favorite. But if you had to pick a favorite one, what would it be, and what is it that you most enjoy about playing it?
One favorite tune on the record, I'd probably say Roots. It was the first tune I wrote for the album. And it's the tune I wrote when I was listening to a lot of Martinique and Field recordings. Well, one recording in particular. And the sound stuck in my head. And I was actually at Hart Recital Hall. That's where I did most of the writing for this album. And I sat there and it came out. And it's a tune where we go through quite a few different moods on it. Because it's about a search. So that's probably my favorite tune. But it is like choosing one of your children as the favorite.
Like in the era of the big record companies and the rock and roll and that kind of thing, that people toured to promote their albums. And I would argue that now that's changing for a lot of reasons because of the internet, in part, that people have exposure to different kinds of bands. But I would say, especially with jazz, it seems like the album is almost there to promote the live playing, because there is that element that you can't quite capture even on the very best recording.
I'm of the school that you have to tour to support an album. I'm from that school. By the end of this tour, we would have done about 35 dates in support of the record. Yeah, the album is, I mean, a lot of musicians use a record as a calling card. It's a way to reach out to presenters to get them interested in booking the band. It's also a way to develop a link with your audience, because you do records, you do quite a few. And over time, it becomes a sound, it becomes a color, it becomes who you are, and it's something that people can connect with. Also, it's simply for documentation purposes, in my mind. You know, my one of my teachers, Marcus Roberts, he told me straight up, he's like, always document what you're doing. I mean, it might be good, it might be bad, but always document it, just because that's the only way you can know if you're growing or not.
You just turned 30 this summer.
Don't remind me.
Don't worry, it's not too bad up here. But you've had, really, by anybody's standards, an enormous amount of success in your music. So what are you still hoping to do over the next 10 years, say?
Next 10 years with my musical career, get more chances to play my music with my band. Get to play more with my idols, you know, my heroes, people that I grew up listening to their music, and people whose music I've studied. I would love to be able to get to interact with them on a musical level on a bandstand.
Who's the number one?
Number one, Roy Haynes. Love his music, love his playing. I mean, there's so many that, you know, that I would love to get a chance to play with. Roy Haynes, Chick Corea. I'm a big fan of Chick Corea's music. So many.
Etienne Charles, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
For Current State, I'm Melissa Benmark.
And the concert Jazz After Hours featuring the Etienne Charles Quintet begins at 7 p.m. tonight at the Broad Art Museum on the MSU campus in East Lansing. And during the TV breaks of the Detroit Tiger game last night, I dutifully checked out WKAR-TV, and up popped MSU legend Greg Kelser, Special K from the 79 National Championship team. Kelser is the first guest on a new program that airs tonight on WKAR-TV. It's Current Sports with Al Martin on television tonight at 10 o'clock. In the program, Greg Kelser describes the durable legacy of the Bird Magic confrontation in the 79 NCAA National Championship.
They were the top players in the nation vying for the championship. It was a coming together of, you know, tremendous and you know, maybe even unmatched proportions. Those two guys, and Indiana State was an undefeated team trying to finish out an undefeated season. That captured everybody's imagination. It got people that really weren't even into basketball watching. And then you throw in the other elements. And let's be honest about it. Race played a part in that, you know, because you had a black kid against a white kid. And all of that was part of the backdrop.
Greg Kelser joining WKAR's Al Martin tonight at 10 on WKAR-TV, Current Sports. That's our Thursday show. Coming up Friday on Current State, a Syrian-born professor visiting East Lansing from Utah offers his thoughts on the Syrian conflict. Also, live music from the MSU Community Music School. That and more Friday on Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.